So last time we were talking about this notion of architectural determinism. Is it possible for the physical environment to actually determine our behavior? That's the word in the literature that this idea is known as architectural determinism. I guess I'm a little hesitant about the word determine. Shape, I like Winston Churchill's word, we shape our buildings, thereafter our buildings shape us. Is architecture a mechanism for shaping who we are? Absolutely. Determine is a little hard, but we discussed last time this kind of not so much cause and effect, not so much hand and glove fit, not so much that I can do a certain physical environment, it will determine how people behave in it, but much more that there is an influence, there is a very powerful mechanism for shaping human behavior. And we described it as there are conforming uses, and those things are pretty predictable. There are implied uses. They're suggested. Maybe they happen. Maybe they don't happen. And then there are accommodated uses that are fairly unpredictable and that may well be stimulated by that physical environment. It is shaping behavior, but in ways that might not be able to be predicted. Buildings last a long time. What might provoke a certain kind of behavior now, in 50 years, it may provoke a completely different accommodated behavior in the building. So I like that looser fit. And then we looked at a number of buildings, in particular Baker House by Alvar Aalto, this building that, at this point, 5,000 or 6,000 students have lived in that building, and many, many, many testimonials about how it changed their lives, about how it really did shape their ability to make friends and to become a part of a community. Hugely influential building. And we can see just the moves and the techniques that Aalto was using, very much educated by people like Leon Festinger and Kurt Schachter, who had analyzed similar housing environments on the MIT campus in the years previous to that. And then we looked at the final example last time at La Tourette, where the effect is, yes, it definitely is the arrangement of rooms and how their lifestyle is kind of encapsulated in physical environment. But way, way more than that, it also is a kind of emotional determinism. It's a psyche, a point of view, a frame of mind that is set up in the architectural environment that definitely has a powerful effect on the people that live there. So I ask you in your Twitter card question, can you think of a physical environment that has shaped you, that has had some effect on your behavior or who you are? We got some great examples, some hugely profound and some kind of minor, and both of those are totally legit. So here are a few of them. My dorm, Scottish Rite dorm, my freshman year, had small rooms, and I shared a bathroom with three other girls. I came to UT with no girlfriends, so this gave me no choice but to make fast friends. Also, we have one big cafeteria downstairs, and I think I talked and sat with a new girl for the first month of living there every meal. This social environment shaped me as a person. Someone else says, the current house I live in Hyde Park is full of character. The backyard has a huge deck, two large trees, and spacious yard area. Naturally, I want to share this backyard with people, and thus the past 2 years have been filled with backyard parties and barbecues that would not have happened in an apartment in West Campus. Somebody else says, whenever my family goes to Mexico to visit our expanded family, we stay at my great-grandmother's house, where all the rooms are connected through a door or passageway covered with curtains. It is structured to make an outline of a square that connects to a courtyard in the center that's outdoors. The design of the house and its openness allows us to socialize with our family 24/7. And we have the opportunity to make up for lost time and feel very close to them. Someone else says, when I visited the 9/11 Museum and Memorial in New York City, it shaped my behavior. The memorial space seemed very quiet and was such a contrast to the busy city life surrounding it. I instantly began talking softly, and as I walked around the exhibit, I had a different feeling. This area seemed to be on mute in comparison to the rest of the city. Someone else says, because my dorm has private bathrooms, no one on my floor is friends. We just avoid eye contact when we pass each other because we haven't really had a chance to meet. Someone else says, this is silly now that I think about it, but when I was younger, I had a very hard time falling asleep at night because of a fear that someone was going to break into my house at night and take me away. I think this is because my bedroom was the last room on the hallway, which was connected to the garage and very far from my parents' bedroom. So I thought that I was in danger and that my parents wouldn't even know if something happened. Oh my God, that's just so huge. The psyche sometimes of a little kid, just by where your bedroom is, and what a big effect. Someone else says, I too have stayed in a monastery for one night during a choir tour, and it very much makes you more contemplative. You can't talk at meals or after 9 p.m., and we found that even during those hours that we could talk, we just had less to say. Someone else says, when I was in elementary school, I was part of a gifted and talented program, and our classroom was really different from the normal classroom. Instead of having individual desks, we sat at round tables to encourage collaborative thinking. Also, we didn't have chairs. Instead, we had bouncy exercise balls to sit on. This gifted and talented classroom was very open and inviting, unlike my regular uniform classroom. It encouraged us to be different, think outside the box. Those are really good observations, and just multiply that time. Thousands and thousands and thousands of buildings and places that are in your life and affect, you know, who you are and how you think and how you socialize and what kind of community you're a part of and so on. So today we're expanding this notion of human factors, right, in architecture. And this is actually going to be a pair of lectures, one today and one next Tuesday, that are on humanism. And I'm going to give a definition here of humanism that you should definitely write down. And that's kind of the core of what we're going to be talking about at a smaller scale today, and then at the larger, more urban scale on Tuesday. So humanism is a doctrine or attitude centered on human interests or values. A philosophy that asserts the dignity and worth of mankind and the capacity for self-realization through reason. Now, I said that too fast, but I'm going to slow down now. There are four major points there. It is a doctrine or attitude, number one, centered on human interests or values. So we're going to be talking about a way of designing buildings that are centered on human interests or values. Second part, it is a philosophy that asserts the dignity and worth of mankind. It asserts the dignity and worth of mankind. This says that human beings are important. They have dignity. They deserve respect. We should listen to them. We should respond to them. Asserts the dignity and worth of mankind. The third point is that it's a philosophy that emphasizes the capacity for self-realization. It emphasizes the capacity for self-realization. All of us can either realize our potential or we cannot realize our potential. But we have the capacity for something higher, better self-realization, and it recognizes that. And then the fourth point is that it recognizes that capacity for self-realization through reason. Reason is the fourth point. One can logically, analytically think through how we could make this environment encourage self-realization, encourage a fulfillment of the people that live in that environment. So as a whole, humanism is a doctrine or attitude centered on human interests and values, a philosophy that asserts the dignity and worth of mankind and the capacity for self-realization through reason. So this is a whole kind of area of philosophy that would go back to many, many, many important philosophers, all the way back to Plato and Socrates, but certainly in the 19th century, very, very prominent strain of philosophy, Johann Wolfgang Goethe in Germany, in the United States, Emerson, Thoreau, this sort of notion of humanism. Humans are something we need to pay attention to, and we can understand our psychology, the birth of psychology in the 19th century in America as a field of study. And then how do we then encourage self-realization? How do we optimize the human potential that is within us? Now, in architecture, that often speaks to things that are maybe more simple, more unpretentious. This is not about shining your ass, showing everybody how hot shit you are, or it's not about, it's kind of genuinely about respect and dignity and self-realization. And I think in design in general, we can think of things that are incredibly humanistic in their design. And then we can think of things that are just kind of fancy or cool or showy. And I'm not knocking that. I mean, those are things that are based more in form. But this is based more in the visual and character of a design object is reflective of what it does and how it serves. So let's take two examples here. One thing is, if I were teaching this class 50 years ago, you would all be dressed in a very, very different way. We dress differently in different eras, but these days, probably 30, 40% of you, maybe more, are wearing blue jeans. Now, I would say that blue jeans are very, very humanistic design. They're not fancy material, they're just freaking denim. Denim is extremely durable. You can wash it like crazy. It just holds up very, very well. The way that blue jeans are put together, they have flat felled seams, so it's not just like you run a line of thread and make a seam, but you actually seam it once and then you flip it over and you seam it a second time. And that's like right there. That's a flat felled seam right there. It's got you like two rows of stitching. That makes it tougher, stronger. It's going to last longer. So those are extremely serviceable pants. I mean, they're made of this durable material. They're put together in this more sturdy way. Some jeans, especially Levi's, even have rivets. So like little metal things that connect where there are joints that have a particular strain put on them. They reinforce that with a rivet. All of these are humanistic design. They're making a pair of pants. It's not about being fancy or being some fine fabric or being some exotic design. It's very, very serviceable. They're comfortable. They last a long time. They look good. Not spectacular, but they look good. They're very humanistic. They respond to your body, your comfort, your practicality. And that's why we all wear blue jeans so much. Okay, so that's one example. Another maybe example of humanistic design would be something like a wine bottle. And wine bottles are made particularly for the human hand to interact with them. The diameter of them is just the right diameter for you to grasp it and hold it firmly and pour. They also have a kind of neck that focuses that pour so that you don't spill it so much. Much easier to pour out of a thin-necked wine bottle than just an open like a glass and trying to pour precisely. They also are, they stand sturdy on the table. They're not easy to knock over. They generally, even at the bottom, if you've ever looked, they have more glass concentrated in the bottom of the wine bottle than at the top, so they sit firmly on the table. They're not wobbly. This is practical, serviceable, human interactive design. And there's something incredibly beautiful about that shape of a wine bottle that just comes out of how it's used, how it interacts with us, what its purpose is. So today we're going to be looking at this small scale, at things like wine bottles or blue jeans, but in a more architectural sense primarily. And I want to start by looking at this very interesting contrast between two design objects at the scale of furniture. And I'm going to make the argument here that there are six things that when we're designing objects like this, there are six things that make them more humanistic. The first is that they are made of plain materials. So generally, we're looking at things that are serviceable here, not that are particularly impressive. So often they're simple and plain materials. The second thing is that there's sensible construction. It's logical, this notion of reason. We've thought through it. It's put together in a probably economical, but certainly sensible way in terms of construction. The third thing, hugely important, it's comfortable. It interacts with the body well. It interacts with the way we use it, the way we operate as human beings and our physiognomy is beautifully interrelated with the design object. The fourth thing is practicality, that they operate durably and reliably, and they're practical. The fifth thing is cleanliness, that there's something kind of hygienic and safe and secure about them. And the sixth thing is absence of pretension or ornament. Never sort of saying, I'm richer than you, I'm better than you, I'm cooler than you. Not a put down to anybody else, but they're not pretentious. Okay, those six things. Now I want us to look at these two pieces of furniture up on the screen here, and I would say that the one on the left, I think that actually is, it's called a highboy. It's a French piece from the 19th century. I gotta say, I think it's a cool-ass thing. I'm not denigrating the piece of furniture on the left. In a museum, if you're looking at it, it is cool. And honestly, if you bought it and you put it in your bedroom, people would probably come over and say, holy shit, what is this? You know, it's a conversation piece. It's definitely a kind of, you know, spectacular piece of furniture. But there is nothing particularly humanistic about this piece of furniture. So let's think for a moment. This high boy it's about 7 feet tall. So the drawers that you're seeing up here, right there, those are about a little over six feet tall. So let's say I put my socks in that drawer and I'm pulling it out and I can't even see into that drawer. No way. And by braille, feeling around, trying to figure out which ones are the pink socks or, you know, which ones are the black socks. Completely impractical. Oh my God. Plus even just, you know, the action of pulling out the drawer up there, way more difficult than pulling out the drawer with the kind of leverage of our body lower down. So why the hell are there drawers way up at the top of that, way above anybody's eye height? So it's not very practical. It's not related to the human body. It isn't. It doesn't center on mankind. It centers on some other notion of prettiness or form. The little handles on this, the little wire things that are made to look like kind of leaves, And you can barely get my big fingers. I can barely get them in there. And then when you pull it, it's like cuts your finger. The wire is this little skinny thing. And when you're trying to pull it, it isn't comfortable on your finger. Yeah, you can get that drawer open, but man, that's a stupid size and shape and material characteristic of all those pulls on those drawers. And then what the hell are these legs? Like it's like a lion or something with a foot down here. And what are seashells? What do seashells have to do with storing your clothes? These funny little urns up here. So what's in there? I don't know. Incense. And the funny shapes. And then there's sort of inlaid wood. Very, very fine material and beautiful craft. But I don't know, it's like this is a British piece of furniture, but it's Chinese scenes, like of people in China wearing Chinese hats and doing strange things. So it's, I don't know, it's exotic, it's interesting. I'm not knocking it, but I'm saying this is not what we're talking about. This is not humanistic design. On the right, we have a similar size piece of furniture, but completely different values that lead to the design of this one. Now, the top shelves up here, and we're trying to store things pretty high here, but you open them up like cabinets, and then you can reach and you can put things on those top shelves, and you can see they're not very deep. You can see what's there, and you can get access to it pretty easily. Then the next tier of storage down, these are the things that are right, you know, so we're here to here, right where my arms are. The cabinet doors there flip down. So when they're up, they conceal what's behind it. When those are closed, of course, they conceal what's behind it. But when those flip up, it's, it's tidy. But when they come down, there's a little lip here so that the chest is deeper here than it is there, and that door becomes a table or a desk, and it makes a very good writing surface, and the writing surface is angled so that the way our elbows, you know, sit, so the elbow's a little lower here and the hand is a little higher, very easy to write in that position, and then you can pull up the chair and you've got a desk made out of it there. And then when you don't need the desk, you flip it up. And of course, when it's a desk, then it's got all the little cubbies for your paper. And this was done in the 19th century also. Your ink and your inkwell and all those kinds of things that needed to be in here as well. And then the lower portion where it gets deeper, that's where the drawers are. That's where the leverage of your body makes it easy to pull a drawer out. And in that case, you can see down and you can see the things in the drawers. That's where it makes the most sense to have a drawer, down low like this, where you pull it out and you look into it, not up like this, where it's a crazy-ass thing to do. So everything about this one thinks of how is the person operating, what is comfortable for them, what achieves their goals logically, how is it made, how is it put together. And the whole thing, it follows these six principles really well. It's made of plain materials, just wood boards. It's very sensible construction. They're all rectilinear because when you saw a piece of wood, it makes a rectilinear form. The blade of the saw is flat. This is just sensible how you make this wood into this kind of construction. It's very comfortable. It's comfortable to open the drawer. It's comfortable to look in and get the things you need out of there. It's very practical. It doubles as a desk as well as a storage unit. Does multiple things. Very clean lines. Sort of elegant, simple that way. And an absence of pretension or ornament. Nobody's saying, you know, look how rich I am. Look how fancy I am. It's an everyday piece of equipment. Now, this one is done by the Shakers. It's a piece of Shaker furniture. The Shakers were a very interesting culture where they were all about humanism. And we'll look at a whole village they designed in a little while. But this is it comes from that set of values and that kind of culture. So here again on the left, that's a rocking chair, which is a shaker chair. Many of the same values generating that. On the right is another 19th century English chair. And this one is just, oh my God, this one is so, so beautifully designed. And you can look at that chair and you can just, and I think most people would look at that chair and that's a handsome chair. Is it a badass, you know, wild, catch your eye, crazy chair? No, it's a very simple chair. But every decision in it is so completely thought through. And every element of it is all about it being the most comfortable, the most amenable chair it can possibly be. So even the shape of the legs here, it splays out a little in the back and out a little in the front so that it's broader at the bottom than it is higher up, which makes it more sturdy. This is not a tippy chair. This one sits very, very firmly and sturdily on the ground. The back legs are thicker than the front legs. That's because the weight of our ass sitting on the back of that with our back on it puts more weight on those back legs than on the front legs, and it acknowledges that in the construction of the chair. The little rails that connect them there mean that each of these is not on its own to support. It shares the load, and that makes it more sturdy by having those rails across there. The joints in this, see, this is a certain dimension that is required to take the loads, more down here, less up here. But then when you get the seat intersecting with that, it thickens up. It transfers that load from the seat down into the leg, and it gets fatter there where it needs to be fatter. Just logical. Then let's talk a little about, so in terms of materials and construction, it's everything so sensible in this, so practical, so amenable. Now, you're going to have your butt sitting on that. And so let's imagine this could easily be a chair for a dining room table, and I'm going to sit for this meal for a couple of hours, a social meal. And you know, if I sit my butt on wood for that period of time, at a certain point, especially if you've got a skinny butt, like your bones wearing on that wood. So, of course, it's not wood where your butt connects with the chair. It's a weave of sisal, these fibers. And they're woven in such a way that there's a concavity right there that matches perfectly with the convex shape of your butt. So it's accepting that part of your physiognomy, and it's softer, and there's a little give to it so that there's added comfort, especially if you sit in the chair a long time. It's got a nice high back, and there's actually a slight curve in the back that acknowledges the curve of the back of your shoulders. It also acknowledges that you might want to, you know, lean your head back and gives a little support for that as well. Again, everything's sort of thicker and chunkier down here where all the loads are, and then it gets to be thinner and lighter as it goes up here and has less pressure and weight on it. You can't tell so well on those arms that those arms splay out a little bit. Just as when you sit down and your elbows are there, they're in a kind of arc like that. And the arm follows your arm. And then at the end of it, there's a little rounded thing there that is just perfect for putting your fingers around. That's the shape your hand makes at the end down there. Everything is about the human body, interaction with the human body, response to the human body, comfort, practicality, that's where humanism lies. So let's expand that up to a little bit bigger environment. This is a whole Shaker village, Canterbury Village in New Hampshire. And these people were, they were sweet people. They basically, everyone in New England knew the Shakers because they would take in orphaned children. So if, I don't know, a kid's parents died, or if there were some other problems in the family and a kid, you know, that just didn't have anywhere to go, there were no other family members that could take care of them, the Shakers were well known to say, we'll take in any kid who has a need like that. And they would not just take care of them, they would adopt them into their family, and they would treat them just exactly like their own children. And that was a really beautiful thing. There was no need for any kind of, you know, governmental social services in the 18th century in New England, because the Shakers just took care of this. They primarily were an agricultural community, but they also manufactured things. They manufactured clothes primarily. And they were famous for making these very simple sweaters, very practical New England sweaters. And in fact, when you think of that sort of quintessential New Englander in their cold winter and their big bulky wool sweater, those were really Shaker sweaters, very humanistic kind of clothing. So they're people who really do believe in the dignity and worth of mankind, and people who are really trying to help people with self-realization. So how does that express itself in the buildings? Again, all of these same things we've been talking about. Certainly very plain materials. They're in New England. They're agricultural people. The first thing they do when they want to make an agricultural area is they have to cut down the trees, because New England is covered with forest. And the trees are there as useful building materials then. So they obviously would build out of wood. Then as they start to farm their land, they've got to take all the rocks that are there. In New England is also famous for lots of rocks in the soil, and those rocks come up constantly because of the freeze-thaw cycle in New England. So they would also take those rocks out of the field, and those are potential building materials as well. So what they make their buildings out of are the stones that they collect in the field and the wood, the timber that they harvest in just making their agricultural lands. So use plain, easily accessible materials, and then they do them with very simple, very logical construction. You know, the soil has moisture, and wood doesn't like moisture. It rots when it's got moisture, so obviously you're not going to put the wood next to the dirt. Instead, you put the stone next to the dirt, and you build in the foundations and a kind of basement out of the stone, and then above that, you start constructing with wood when you're no longer vulnerable to the moisture. And you saw the boards, and you make these clapboards that shed the water very logically, and that you know, add up to a very simple and economical and easy to build kind of shape in the building. So plain materials, sensible construction. They're also very much about comfort. You know, that simple little rocking chair, even that notion of rocking, there's just something comfortable about rocking. It works with the rhythms of the body, the heartbeat, something just comfortable about rocking. And they're all over rocking. So comfort's a big thing here. Practicality, this would have been one of their kind of work rooms, and they want that to serve multiple purposes. So this might be a place where they would lay out their clothing and cut it. So they have these big tables that are very practical for the industry that they're doing, which is making clothes. But also that's right next to the kitchen here. And that's a buffet where they can lay out, you know, if they have a large group dining, then they can lay that out there. So they're constantly thinking of just what's multifunctional and what's practical, and they're building the furniture and the spaces so that they work in that flexible, practical way. It's all about live-work here. They didn't have their factory separate from their home. They were producing this in the home. They're very family-centric, and the whole family would be working together on making this clothing in the home and integrated with their living. All about cleanliness, super hygiene here. There even is, all of the furniture is very lightweight, so you can pick it up and clean under it. Even their beds kind of sit up higher than a normal bed, and so that you don't get dust bunnies under your bed, and it's kind of nasty under there. They have this interesting rail up here, where when they start to clean up, they take those ladder back chairs like that, and they hang them on the wall, as you're seeing right here, and that way they can mop or dust or whatever they want to on the floor, and then they can take it back down and put it there. But they're super about trying to keep everything clean. And then the final thing is everywhere, this kind of absence of pretension or ornament. Basically, they're just simple. No more than is necessary. Very, very plain. And there's a beauty in that, I think. I mean, these buildings have survived a very, very long time. Canterbury Village now is open to the public. It's a place where people go and find it incredibly charming and quaint and beautiful. Was it overtly made to be strong form? Not really. It became beautiful because it represents a set of values and a way of life that's very humanistic. And I think we associate this with a kind of beauty that we appreciate a lot. One of my favorite buildings in the village is this place where it's a communal wood storage place. They're in freaking New England. It's cold, cold, cold. I was in Boston last weekend, and it's like April, and it snowed. Blizzard snow Sunday morning. They got 5 inches of snow Monday. It's cold in this climate. And they're fueling their heat primarily with the wood that, again, they're cutting from the forest to make their farmland. So this is a place where communally they stack their wood to keep it out of the damp and keep it dry for use in burning in the wintertime. So there's a whole building with a deep overhang so that the water doesn't, the rainfall doesn't get on the wood. It's ventilated at the bottom, so it's placed up on these little stone piers, and there's a ventilation space below, so the air can move through it and, again, keep it dry and not collect any moisture. There even is a little vent at the top. Warm air rises, so as all of that would heat up, it would then exhaust out there, and it would bring this ventilation through the whole thing. Again, practical. Simple, and there's something just kind of beautiful about this wood shed that does a very simple job, but does it really elegantly. So, is there a way that architecture comes out of these humanistic values? And I want to make the point that Shaker architecture is a beautiful example of that, but there are many other ways that can happen too, and not necessarily with people of modest means. This is a very, very wealthy family that was building a new house in Los Angeles, or Pasadena, which was a suburb of Los Angeles. So this is the Gamble House. This is the firm Procter & Gamble that is there, based in Cincinnati, makes all kinds of soaps and household goods. Well, this is the Gamble family. They had been living in Cincinnati. Mr. Gamble began to have some respiratory problems. And his doctor said, you got to get out of the cold Northeast. You need to move to a warmer climate. So he and his family decided to build a house in Southern California. And everybody else, there were lots of wealthy people from the East Coast who were moving to Southern California. And generally, they built a big Mediterranean villa, or they built a big Tudor mansion. And you can see all over the Hollywood Hills and places like that, you can see these people moving and building those kinds of houses. But the Gambles had, I would say, although they're very wealthy people, they had more humanistic values. They weren't interested in showing their neighbors what a badass, pretentious house they could build, but instead they built what was in some ways a very modest house. Now, it's huge and it's beautifully crafted, but it also has some of these humanistic values. It's made of plain materials. These are the stones that are in the Arroyo Seca right next to it, these big weathered stones that they use to make parts of the house. There's a kind of overburnt brick that is manufactured locally, and they're the refuse bricks. They're the ones that exploded in the kiln, and they're using them to make a kind of texture in the house. California's got all these redwood trees. In this area especially, there was tons and tons of redwood around. So the house is basically made out of redwood for the whole thing. And in making this house, the architects Green and Green were inventing a kind of vocabulary that was meant to be for every man, not just for the rich people, but for every man. And it worked. It was kind of the invention of what's called the bungalow style. And you can go through lots of neighborhoods of Austin in the immediately following era, and you see these little bungalow houses in Hyde Park or in Travis Heights or in these neighborhoods. They really came from this invention of a vocabulary that would be for everyone. Anybody could afford this. It could be a little bigger, it could be a little better crafted, and that would be a high-end house. But those same forms would be very practical for a modest house with, you know, 800 or 900 square feet, two bedrooms, one bathroom, and there are dozens of those all over in these neighborhoods in Austin and most other American cities. Again, it's plain materials, wood, in this case, red wood. Very sensible construction. A lot of the expression is about the truss or the purlins or beams that go along here and expressing those, the outriggers from the roof, the deep overhangs, because it's, you know, it's a warm climate in Southern California, trying to keep that sun out. Very practical there. And the way it's made is all expressed. You see all the rafter tails and all the framing of the roof. It's just plain construction. Super comfortable house. Oh my God, I was back there again last November. I've probably been to this house 5 or 6 times. I love this house. But I was in Los Angeles with my brother. He'd never been to that house, so we took an afternoon and went out to Pasadena, and it's just wonderfully comfortable there. There's so many outdoor spaces. So there's a place to dine out here off of the dining room. There are sleeping porches there and there. Pretty much every bedroom has a sleeping porch. So you can just take the bed and wheel it out, big double doors, and sleep outside. Because so much of the year in Southern California, there's very pleasant weather. And how kind of healthy and natural it would feel. They moved from Cincinnati for a reason. They were trying to get the better weather. So why not enjoy it with these comfortable outdoor dining areas and sleeping porches. Through the whole thing, just this absence of pretension, everything very practical, little places to sit on the porch that are built into the house. And even when you're making a kind of gate for an entry, it's just very simple, very practical. And if there's any ornament at all, it's only in the way joints go together, the way two pieces of wood meet and a kind of peg joint that puts them together. So they're inventing in a way a vocabulary that is just about self-realization, about making a house that's comfortable and practical for the people that use it. The next couple of examples kind of look at associated accoutrements and design in this same era. There's a guy named Gustav Stickley. He actually designed some of the furniture for the Gamble house. But it's very practical furniture, very sturdy. And oh my God, this stuff, you know, people pass this on for generations. If you own a piece of Stickley furniture that stayed in your family, it's still as good as new. It's and again, it's, you know, sometimes rocking chairs, that kind of comfort. Upholstery, it's leather and wood, durable, practical materials. The Stickleys were interested in a kind of interior design or an environment that would be very humanistic, very comfortable, not pretentious, and it really had a big effect on American living in the 19th century going into the 20th century. Then there also is another strain, this sort of 19th and 20th century emphasis on humanism. But there is in modern design often this idea of really making it just as functional and practical and beautiful as possible. This we looked at last time in Baker House, that dining room below, living room above. But now I want to just focus on that little piece of handrail right there. And it is so beautifully designed in response to trying to keep the communication between the dining room and living room open. We're trying to get a sense of community in these social spaces in the building. So just as little obstruction of that as possible. It's completely open looking down there. But then there is that rail to kind of lean on and look over. And it's got steel supports. That makes a lot of sense. So it's as strong as possible and as little obstruction of the view as possible. But then for that rail itself, it's made out of wood because wood is more the temperature of your hand, as you might touch it, than steel would be. And the shape of that wood, you can barely see it in the photograph, but it is just exactly the shape of your hand. It has a place for the heel of your hand and then for your fingers to wrap around it. And just very, very human-centric design. This is another handrail in Baker House. And again, the shape of it is just exactly right. So when you grab it, it just reflects the shape of your thumb against your hand, the shape of your fingers, just the right diameters there, but then also sturdy enough with the bulk down below that it just, this is a long rail and it's strong enough to take those loads. So that handrail is all those six principles we were talking about. It's plain materials, it's sensible construction, it's comfortable, it's practical, it's very clean lines, no pretension or ornament, and yet very beautiful, very sensual, very organic, very much in as a reflection of human interaction. Aalto, just like Stickley, did these whole interiors. He designed furniture, he designed rugs, he designed everything to kind of give that overall feeling of humanism on interiors. This is a house he did for a very, very wealthy family in Finland. Meijer and Gullikson was his client on this. And he designed pretty much all of the furniture. I mean, they had fantastic art. That's a Ferdinand Leger there. There's a little Degas sculpture over here just off the photograph, but all of that was meant to be very comfortable and yet really, really beautiful design. A good example here is that column. So this is meant to be a social space. They would entertain, have parties, have large numbers of people come over. So they wanted a big open space where the people could flow nicely. So he uses steel columns to support and make a clearer span there. So the steel is important structurally for making those long spans. But then he thinks of, I'm here at a party and I lean up against that column and I'm in freaking Finland and it's freezing cold outside. And when I touch steel, steel is cold to the touch. And he thought that's not comfortable. So he takes leather and he wraps the column at those heights between where you might touch it, from about your knees to a little above your shoulder. Anywhere you might touch that column is wrapped in leather, and leather is skin. It has the temperature of your skin, so there's not that uncomfortable cold feeling of the steel. Aalto's amazing at details. This is a door pull. What mostly in the U.S. we have door knobs. Door knobs are stupid. Door knobs are stupid design. If you're trying to turn something, why would you have something that's slippery and round? Why wouldn't you have something that's a lever so that you put pressure on it and it opens? And especially for an older person or someone who's arthritic or this is really, it's stupid design, a doorknob. This is in the Maison Carré, in just outside of Paris. Monsieur Louis Carré was an art dealer, and he was an older man. And so Aalto designed this special door handle that would replace doorknobs. And it has that lever action on it so that it's easy, even if you're arthritic, to get the door open. The other thing is just look at the shape of everything in there. The fact that it's wider here and narrower there. Take your hand and grasp something. When you grasp, your thumb and your first finger make a tighter circle, and your little pinky out here makes a wider circle. And that is perfectly reflected in the fact that's tighter and that's wider. Also, you don't want your hand to slip off here, so there's a little bit of a notch here to keep your hand firmly there. The other thing is, of course, it's made out of brass. That brass would be a little cold to touch. Alta wouldn't want that, so he makes the leather straps that go around there. That gives you more traction on it, so it's not as slippery. It also makes it a temperature that's more the temperature of your body. Holy moly, how does he think of everything? Everything in there is really meant to interact with the human body. On the right, this is the door pull for a big store he did in Helsinki. This is Stockmann's bookstore. It's the biggest bookstore in all of Finland. And it's got a children's book section, and it's got a young adult's book section. It's got every kind of book you can imagine. If you want to buy a book in Finnish, just in case you wanted to buy a book in Finnish, this is the place. Not many of us want to do that, but this is the place. But he's cognizant of there are all kinds of people coming here. And people come in different sizes. Some people are little bitty short people. They're little, they're children. And then sometimes, especially Finns, some of them are big, tall people. So he makes this door pull that has a pull low for children, has a pull medium for most people, has a pull high for those big, crazy, tall Finnish guys. And then look at the shape of that pull. He notices that if I reach out to grab something, again, just reach your hand out to grab something. You do not grab vertically like this. Because of the way your shoulder and your elbow and your wrist work, there's a slight angle when you reach out to grab something. There's that slight angle. And the door pull is exactly that slight angle three times there. Okay, this is a sensibility. This is something you get in your head. That's what design is. That's what architecture is. That's what physical environments are. They're meant to serve. They're meant to help people realize their goals, what they want to do. They're about comfort. They're about practicality. How can I make all of the building environment respond as thoroughly as that door handle or those door pulls do in this case? This is another example just to let you show Alto doesn't have any monopoly on this. A couple of times ago, we looked at Exeter Library in Exeter, New Hampshire, designed by Louis Kahn. This little desk there, oh my God, beautiful humanistic design there. You're a high school student. You're going to the library to study. What do you need there? So he's got a little angle over here. That's for your backpack or your coat or all those other accoutrements you're likely to have with you, and get it there and get it out of the way. Then you've got a nice size work surface there that you can spread your books and your writing material out. It is lit from above by a big clear story window that lets generous natural light down into that space. There also is this little window that you can open up or you can shut. This one's shut. This one's open. It's got a little sliding wood door. So if you want a view out, it's a perfect little me-sized window to view out. Or if you don't want any distraction at all, you can close it off and you still get the natural light down on your work surface. This little angle right there, this guy's leaning back and he's enjoying a little break in the view there. But if you decide to really nerd it up and hunch over and start working, that little thing there pulls him out of the public space and gives him a little private cubby there. And so somebody can walk by as they do here, and he's not distracted by them. He's thinking of privacy. He's thinking of work surface. He's thinking of light. He's thinking of view. He's thinking of the whole act of studying and what it is you want in terms of concentration, in terms of relief. Everything handled beautifully. Here, two chairs, two modern chairs. And this is in an era where modernism is thinking about functionalism. And so on the left is a chair by Marcel Breuer. Actually, I saw that in a museum in Boston the other day. That's called the Vasily chair. It's a very famous chair designed by Marcel Breuer. Marcel Breuer wanted to make a very practical chair. Lightweight, easy to move around, good for modern life where you might be moving from place to place from time to time. And he's thinking, what can I make it out of? And he's riding his bicycle one day, and he thinks, whoa, bicycles, they're lightweight, they're strong, they last a long time. I'll make it out of chrome-plated tubular steel. So the frame of the chair is chrome-plated tubular steel. And then in between, there just are these stretched pieces of, sometimes it's canvas, sometimes it's leather. But it makes a very technologically functional, easy to mass produce, lightweight, easy to transport, all of those kinds of things. Aalto looked at that chair and he said, this is functional from a technical point of view, but it is not functional from a humanistic point of view. This is not a humanistic chair. And his criticism is, number one, when I touch that chrome-plated steel, it's too cold. It's not the temperature of my body. Number two, when I sit on that stretched fabric, and this is absolutely true, it ain't comfortable. And that is not a comfortable chair. You sit in it for 2 minutes, you're good. You sit in it for an hour, and you're crazy uncomfortable. It's not humanistic. And so he says, how can I design a chair that is technologically functional and humanistically functional? So he designed this chair for Baker House, and it's made out of wood. He loved wood for the fact that it had the temperature of your body. Just touch that wood. That's just exactly the temperature of your body. Her elbow is just enjoying that compatible temperature right there. And so he thought that's better than if it's metal, which would have a much colder temperature. But he wanted it technologically lightweight. So in this case, he made little bitty thin plies of wood and then soaked them so that the fibers got softer and then bent them and put them in a mold in this bent shape and glued them up, the layers together. And they become way stronger. Plywood is stronger than the same dimension of wood. But he could make it in a much more fluid shape. And that fluid shape came from exactly how your elbows and arms want to be when you're sitting, so that your elbow is a little lower than your wrist, which is right there, and then your hand looping over right there. That's just the shape of your body. All of this to make it strong as it goes down there and how it's attached. And then the seat itself, oh my God, just the shape of your butt, and then the shape of your knee, and a little bit of concave shape there for your back and the way your shoulders fit in there, and then upholstered so that it actually has some give to it. And I will guarantee you that chair, super comfortable. That one actually, I owned that chair for many years. That's now in my son's living room in Boulder, Colorado. And it is a super, super comfortable chair. All right, how does that then apply to a whole building? We're going to have to quickly run through a couple of ones here. This is Paimio Sanatorium. This is a hospital, essentially. It was for people who had tuberculosis. And in this period, they isolated tuberculin people. And Paimio is out in the country, and these people would have to live there the rest of their life. There was no cure for tuberculosis. You're there for the rest of your life, and you're isolated from other people. He analyzes what is the day like for a person in this sanatorium. And there's a place where they sleep, and they wake up in the morning, and he orients that southeast so that when the morning sun comes up, you get that sun early in the morning streaming in your bedroom window. That gives a view out to the kind of recreation area where people would take walks, so that if you're bedridden, at least you can see other people out there enjoying nature. Or maybe if you're able to go out and about yourself, you see someone down there and say, I think I'll come down and have a walk with them. So the views are nice out to this sort of public space where people take walks out there. So that's oriented perfectly to the sun and to this view. Then there's a wing right here that has the exam rooms, it has the dining room, it has craft rooms, things people could do during the middle of the day. It's oriented due south to catch just as much of that warm winter sun as he possibly can, because it's Finland and it's super cold there. So that's just the perfect orientation there. This is the elevator, stairs, connector. This is the kitchen. All of those are less ideal orientation, but they're not places you hang out for a while. The places where you're really going to spend some time, they're oriented just perfectly to the sun and to the view. There you can see all those individual bedrooms served by a corridor on this side, all of those facing southeast, getting that morning sun. Here are the exam rooms. They're facing due south right here, just that circulation connector and the kitchen right there. And there you're seeing that long facade with all of those patient rooms looking out to that recreation area outdoors. On the patient wing, big, generous windows, where you have a corridor on the other side, completely different function, completely different kind of window. That's just about having a window at your eye height as you're walking along that corridor, giving access to the rooms. There you see that little exam rooms on the lower floor here of that wing facing due south, big double height dining room there, the craft rooms up here, outdoor terrace, sunshades on that south side to get the winter sun, keep the summer sun out, perfectly oriented. Then tucked back behind is the kitchen, but thinking also about those kitchen workers so that they've got clear story windows that let natural light in there, skylights that light their work surfaces inside there, everything thoughtful. This is the patient room. Aalto had a ski accident right before he designed Paimio Sanatorium. And he was in a hospital and in a bed. It was a very bad break and he had to be in traction. That's what they did. So for 6 weeks, he was in a bed. And he said during that period of time, he learned to be a horizontal person. Normally, we experience the world vertically, but he's flat on his back with his leg propped up, and he's a horizontal person. And so a lot of times, these tuberculosis patients, they're confined to bed, and they're horizontal people. How do you design a room differently for a horizontal person? Well, number one, you make the ceiling a color, and you make the walls white. You need a white surface to reflect the light, but the more interesting surface is what they look at all day long. In this room, that's actually kind of a turquoise color, a really rich, interesting color. You don't put the light fixture in the middle of the room. When you look up like that, oh my God, it's in your face, it's glary. So instead, you tuck the light fixture back up here with a little reflection off the ceiling there, but well out of your view when you're lying in bed. He noticed that when he was lying in bed, what was always getting cold were his extremities. Cold feet, cold hands. I don't know if you've been in a hospital, it's uncanny how after a few days, your hands and your feet just can't get warm. So he puts the heating element in the ceiling right here. It's that drop down right there. It's radiant heating meant to heat your feet right at the end down there without making you too stuffy up at your head and your shoulders. He thought it was important to get ventilation, but you certainly wouldn't want to be sedentary and have a draft on you all the time. So he made these windows that they're casement windows that open out and open in. So it's double pane glass, but it allows the air to come through, but never for the air to actually blow onto the sedentary patient. He even designed a very special sink, which you see right there. Tuberculosis patients have to hawk and spit. It's they get phlegm in their throat and they go hawk and spit, and you know you have to use the sink to do this. And it really was annoying the way that most sinks, the water falls down and it splashes back up on you. So he designed a custom sink where the front of it toward you is a slow slope like that. And the water comes down and it hits that angled slope and goes down and doesn't splash back on you. Because these people have to use that sink a lot. And how could we make a better sink for them? Everything in the building is built around function. What, every window for every room is just the right shape and size and orientation for the function that's there. And then in general, it's just this cheery, bright, lots of natural light, bright colors, because it could otherwise be a depressing thing to be secluded like this. But he's trying to make it a more cheerful, upbeat kind of place. So that's a whole building built on this notion of humanism. Here's a very different function of building, a library, that's also built on very much those same ideas. So this is in Viipuri, was Finland, now is Russia. There's a big library reading room space here, and then there's a kind of community space with a lecture hall and with administrative offices on the second floor. So again, he's kind of dividing the functions so he can make them just exactly fit what their needs are. In the library, he's very concerned about light. Aalto was a big reader, and he noticed that when he read, if you're sitting in a chair and you just get comfortable sitting there reading, and you read for about 20 minutes, then you want to shift your weight. You want to get in another position. Your body doesn't want to stay in the same position for long periods of time. But sometimes you'll get the light just right so there's no glare on the page, and it'll be just right for 20 minutes, and then you'll want to shift. But then when you shift, there's glare on the page. And so he's trying to figure out, how can I make the lighting so no matter what posture you're in, it's going to have even diffuse light and there's not going to be any glare. So he makes these skylights at the top, which are actually 6 feet in diameter. He understands exactly what the angle, this low angle of the sun in Finland, so that the sun is coming in and then bouncing off of these and making this very soft, diffuse light throughout the space. So no shadows and no reflection, and trying to make it just as comfortable as it can possibly be for reading. And then at night, he emulates the same light by bouncing the artificial light off the walls and giving, again, no reflection and no shadow as you're reading, both when you're looking for a book in the stacks and also when you're reading a book in the reading room. And the whole design of the place is built around these big skylights and these big open spaces that then have the stacks, not in those creepy rows of books facing each other and they're dark and you're trying to crawl down here and see where the call number is. I mean, most libraries are not humanistic at all. But here he's able to get a lot of efficient stack space because he's sort of making it double high here by making this little walkway around. But then very generous light, very nice social open feeling in the reading room there. Now, in the community room, the lecture hall, it's a completely different situation. Now it's all about sound. And he designs it so that, and this is in the era when they didn't have very good PA systems, and it was all scratchy and artificial, and he hated that. Could we make a room where just naturally you could talk and the sound would move in a very, very good way? So he makes this ceiling that's wavy like that, and the little black areas there are reflective surfaces of the ceiling, and the other areas are absorptive. So when you're in the audience and you make a sound or you cough, it gets absorbed in that direction. But when the speaker speaks here and it hits the ceiling, it's reflected off of these non-absorptive surfaces. So it's a way of distributing the sound from the speaker, but absorbing the sound of extraneous noises coming from the audience. And in that space, it's super easy to hear, because the sound has been dealt with in this very humanistic way. Again, just to make the point that Aalto hadn't got any monopoly on this. This was a very good friend of Aalto's named Eric Brickman. They actually shared an office for a while. He did this place for funerals, this in a cemetery outside of Turku in Finland. And it just, everything in it, the colors, the shape, the light quality, very soothing. This is a difficult time. People are losing a loved one. Very thoughtful about where the body would be, where the eulogist would talk. And when you're looking at that, and all the pews are angled slightly, so you look at the body and you look at the eulogist, but you also have this beautiful view out, a glass wall into the forest. And all of the benches are angled here so that you get the view of the front, but you also get the view out to the forest. So there's this serene, natural, soothing quality to that. And again, bringing some of the nature inside, the soft light, everything thoughtful of that tender moment in human experience. Okay, sorry, I went over a little bit today. No Twitter card question today. See you in class on Tuesday.